You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to our May episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm joined once again by Alan. Hey, Alan.
Hello.
And we will be talking about the propaganda films of Powell and Pressburger. Lots of P's there. Very alliterative. To some extent, I think this episode refers back to last year's podcast episode with Julie and Sam on two Nazi Germany propaganda films. And I think we want to look at these films as films, obviously, but also as propaganda and what that means. So to begin with, Alan, do you have a neat definition of propaganda that we can use here?
I probably could if I could hastily rush onto a dictionary website. But I do always feel like propaganda, it feels like a dirty word. So I find it hard to use propaganda as anything other than something that is sort of a bit manipulative, a bit patriotic. It always feels like it's got this element that I don't like the word. So however I try to define it, I think it would fall within that category.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it, in the German-speaking world, I do think it's especially and understandably a word that's almost exclusively negative, because I think in the German-speaking world, it's very quickly then associated with Nazi propaganda, you know, Goebbels and co, but then also perhaps with the propaganda of the, you know, Soviet Union. And obviously, then you think of, you know, something underhanded, something nefarious, something also that doesn't reveal what it is, that isn't honest about what it is. But I have to say that while I understand where the definition comes from, I think for the conversation that we're going to have, it's perhaps not the most immediately useful definition, because the thing is, if you use that kind of approach, then propaganda differs on which perspective you have. If you agree with it, it's not propaganda. If you disagree, it's obviously propaganda. In that respect, I think perhaps a more neutral, obviously coming from the person living in Switzerland, a more neutral definition might be useful, at least for the conversation. And Wikipedia does define propaganda as, quote, a communication that is primarily used to influence or persuade an audience to further an agenda, which may not be objective and may be selectively presenting facts to encourage a particular synthesis or perception. And I think if you look at that, it also doesn't sound very positive to begin with, perhaps, but communication primarily used to influence or persuade. I think that's the key thing. A lot of communication, especially public communication, is about persuasion. It might even be quite overt about that. And persuasion is always selective about what it says, because it has a perspective, it has a point of view. So does that definition work for you for our conversation?
I think it is worth it in terms of, I think, taking the context of a step back and rather than looking at the material itself, maybe looking at the intentions of the people making it. So why are they producing this media? You also kind of think, well, hang on, if you go too broad with this, everything becomes propaganda, because there's very few people who will be making something that won't have some sort of idea or concept that they'll want to convey to the audience that they're presenting within their sort of narrative, a way to make people reach that similar conclusion. So I think you can draw it too broad that it just takes in everything and then say, well, everything's propaganda. And I don't want to sound like the sort of tinfoil hatted conspiracy lunatic by saying that. But I do think it's useful for reframing when we look at propaganda to not just the material, but who is making that material and why they're making it.
Absolutely. And also in which context, which is something that with the three films that we're going to be looking at will definitely be very, very important. I mean, I do think that, as you say, so much art tries to influence or persuade, and propagandistic art probably does so in order to further a political or ideological agenda. And I think politics too has become something of a dirty word, but I think it doesn't have to be. And I don't think that persuasion as such has to be wrong in and of itself. But the question is, as you say, always, why, in which context, to what end? What are films that you would typically consider propaganda cinema?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is always wartime. So I think the first thing I would think of is the almost like the Nazi propaganda films, because they're sort of famous in their infamy. I also think of those sort of American propaganda films, the very sort of normal voiceover, a very sort of stentorian voiceover that then delivers facts about all the great things that the Americans are doing across the Pacific or everything. I think I sort of associate propaganda probably more with news and the way it's presented that way than necessary in cinema. When you get into cinema, I think the first thing is always the dark side. It's always the Nazis, and maybe also the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. But then I think you also have stuff like this Disney cartoon, The Fuhrer's Face. I don't know whether you've seen that one, which has basically Donald Duck in Nazi Germany. And it spoofs, it lampoons, obviously, Nazi ideology and all of that. There's also, I think, some Hitchcock films like Foreign Correspondent and Lifeboat, which, as you say, are basically made in the context of the war. I would say definitely, at least to some extent, there's some propagandistic DNA in those. When I looked up, you know, what Google says about propaganda cinema, it also mentioned the Battle of Algiers, which I can definitely see. I mean, again, depending on where you come from politically, you might not call it propaganda, but if we take a slightly more open definition, you can see why it could be called propagandistic cinema. And then Battleship Potemkin, which I have to admit to my eternal shame, I have never seen as yet.
I mean, again, the danger is you just go down the route and it becomes so vast that anything becomes propaganda. Like, is Mutiny on the Bounty propaganda? Because, you know, it presents a story, it presents facts, it presents it as a way of, oh, this is how the Royal Navy improved itself and dealt with a huge problem it had. But I don't think it is. It is just a narrative. It is a storyline. It is something that crosses a line from being propaganda to just being a story with a message. And I think that's a very grey line, and I'm not quite sure how I would define it. But I think there's always a problem if you go down the route of defining propaganda, that you almost have to start becoming quite inclusive about it, because it comes from all these different standpoints and viewpoints, and you want to be inclusive. You don't want to say, oh, propaganda is bad because those are the people that do it. You want to admit, oh, we do it as well. It's this broader thing. At some point, you're just taking in all of cinema. And I think that's always a sort of hazy definition of where do you draw the line.
Now let's basically move on to some of the other alliterative P's in our conversation. So we've talked a bit about propaganda pictures, but let's talk about Powell and Pressburg. It's very, very nice that they both start with a P. Where do you stand with respect to Powell and Pressburg? What do you think of them? What do you think of their films? Are you a fan? Are you more kind of neutral Swiss about them?
I'm a huge fan, and I think they were one of the first filmmakers that sort of started me on the journey of being an adult fan of film. That you start looking at films and seeing the names and thinking, I really enjoyed that film. I will watch other films by these people. So especially as that would then require searching. You know, they would be films which you could get hold of, but it wasn't like you'd get it from the local shop that sold the latest releases. You'd have to go into London or somewhere and find a place that had the sort of vintage VHS to date it for sale. So I sort of very much came on board with them quite early on in getting into film. And yeah, no, I'm a huge fan.
I definitely know where you're coming from, though. For me, I think I was lucky in that I only got to know about them and got into them at a point when there had already been something of a Powell and Pressburg revival, which I think is in no small part also thanks to Martin Scorsese, who very much championed them after, I think, especially Powell with Peeping Tom. I think he fell out of grace. But I think also if you look at Criterion, for instance, there has been a release of so many of their films, even some of the lesser known ones. So I think at this point, they're seen as more key and more important to British cinema and to cinema in general than they did for a while. I think for a while, they were seen, I think, unfairly so as being, you know, outdated, outmoded, out of fashion. And I think I see to some extent where that impression might have come from, but it's, I think, extremely reductive. Because their films, I think they're very romantic, but they're also pretty ironic. They're nostalgic, but they're also experimental. They're patriotic, but they're also very critical of parochial patriotism, as far as I'm concerned. And it's exactly this multifaceted view on these issues that I think makes it, I think, inadequate to look at them as, they're these old-fashioned, you know, old fogies in love with Britain.
And I think where a lot of that came off, I think, for a while, is they were seen as, you know, oh, they did make entertaining films, but they were just their own little, I suppose, whimsical world that had come and gone. Like you said, there was an old-fashioned thing. And I think it took Scorsese, it took other commentators to point out that actually they are hugely influential, to sort of remove them from this sort of niche of interesting whimsy that the British film industry produced for a little while, to sort of say, no, they were very important filmmakers. And that sort of reframed the films, because I can remember when I was getting into them, they were liked, the films, but they were liked as oddities. They were liked as sort of standalone. Here's an interesting thing. You know, you won't see other films like this, but it wasn't the same as sort of like, you must watch Hitchcock because Hitchcock has this massive influence over all of cinema and you won't understand the history of cinema without understanding the likes of Hitchcock. They were seen as existing almost as their own separate bubble that could be fun and interesting, but it was its own thing that didn't really go anywhere. It was so whimsical. And I think the recalibration of them as very influential filmmakers had to sort of come from the filmmakers who were influenced by them, saying, no, this is the, you know, championing this film. And that sort of rediscovery has been really interesting.
I knew early on when I got into Paul and Pressburger that Scorsese was into them, and he also said he was influenced by them. And I never quite understood what he meant by that, because, you know, you've got these kind of very whimsical British films, and then you've got Scorsese with Mean Streets. Until I watched, I think it was the Mr. Scorsese, that documentary on Apple, where you also had this juxtaposition of some of the footage, some of the use of color. And I suddenly saw, yeah, I can totally see where Scorsese is coming from by saying he was influenced. It's not just that he liked them, but their DNA is in his films, which is surprising and striking, but it kind of makes sense when you think about it. Now, as we've said, this episode is basically about propaganda cinema and about their propaganda cinema. All three of the films that we'll be discussing have been called propaganda cinema, and I think with just some justification, all three of them are clearly a product of wartime Britain. They all address the audience in the context of World War II and Britain's place in it. And I think there is definitely this objective, perhaps this aim, to persuade the audience of certain things. Would you agree with that take? Do you also see them, at least to some extent, as propaganda films? Or do you think that's an unfair assessment?
They're definitely propaganda films. I think it's very much in their DNA to be propaganda films. And what I find quite thrilling about these films is the element to which they're propaganda, that you look at them and you can start to consider why this film has been made, why they have made the choices that they have made while making these films, because they're unquestionably propaganda. But they are not propaganda that is recognizably the equivalent of what Nazi Germany was churning out at the same time. It is the difference that makes it interesting, while also I think you could not deny they were propaganda, that it's being made for a purpose. It is presenting stuff to persuade. There's almost like a casual desperation in them that they have a purpose and they really want to get to that purpose. And they're not going to let on how histrionic probably people were feeling when the film was being made, that, you know, we're in a war. It's an existential war. But I think that still underpins the films. And I find that genuinely quite thrilling.
I think it's also that if you look at all three of these films, they're not the kind of propaganda that your average propagandist would make. And you can also see why one of these films, we'll get to that, was very much disliked, for instance, by Winston Churchill, who even tried to stop them from making this film. Let's perhaps give a bit of context on the three films and on Powell and Pressburger. So Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, often known as the Archers, which was the name of their production company. So they made 24 films together between 1939 and 1972. Pressburger wrote many of the original stories. The two of them co-wrote the scripts. Powell then directed and Pressburger produced and did work on editing and the use of music. So both of them were very much involved in the creation of these films, in the creative side. Powell was a born Englishman, the son of a Kentish farmer. Pressburger was a Hungarian Jew who had worked in France and Germany, but lost his job when the Nazis came to power and he fled to England in 1935. And I would say with Pressburger especially, it's interesting that he arguably worked on some of the most British films with Powell. And he certainly put his imprint as an immigrant, as someone who chose Britain, England, to his new home. So you see this imprint as an immigrant on these films, I would say. It's also, it gives him an unexpected perspective in some ways on Britain, combined with what I think is fair to say a profound love for it.
I'd agree with that. And I think that lies in a big part of what the initial appeal was, in the sense that it is presenting a Britishness that feels, I think, more inclusive, but also more chosen, rather than a sort of patriotism. We were born, it's in our blood. And, you know, my parents were immigrants to Britain. I grew up like in a household with with foreign parents. And so I think you get to a point where seeing something that is about Britishness, that is, I think, coming from the viewpoint of someone who has grown to sort of, I think, love Britain through choice, having moved there and decided, yes, I adore this place. I think that is within the DNA of these films. And I think I really chimed with that it was something that, you know, you can't embrace the country in the same way that maybe people who were just born there and have their families have been there for a while. So to some extent, it's like, well, what is this country to me? And I think Pressburger is very good at just presenting that without it ever feeling like a lecture.
In some way, I think it's quite telling that it's the two of us doing this episode. As you said, you basically are an immigrant shark to some extent. I mean, I'm also a very, I would say, Paul and Pressburgerian person in some ways, because I am also the child of two immigrants, a German father, an English mother, who both met in Switzerland. So I think this is very much in tune with the three films that we're talking about here.
And I think there's something in sort of very generalized atmosphere of, you know, you have to question the thing you love. And I also think that's maybe something that Scorsese gets as well. That, you know, he has these aspects of his childhood, aspects of the world he grew up in, that he wants to make films about, that to some extent there's an element to which it glamorizes that, but he knows you cannot do that without questioning it. You know, you cannot be into something without also thinking, yeah, but what does this really mean? And does this not have flaws? And I think there's that spirit in their films as well, which is often, this thing is great, but, and the flaws are maybe part of its greatness, but that is still, I think, a questioning spirit of, don't ever go too overboard with what you're into if you're not going to be honest about what might be wrong with it.
And I think that's also why, for instance, someone like Churchill wasn't too happy with them. I mean, their films do idealize a certain idea of Britain, of England, but it is, which idea of England do they choose to idealize, and how do they do it? And it's definitely never uncritical. I mean, it's also interesting, the Archers had a manifesto which included statements like, we owe allegiance to nobody except the financial interests which provide our money, and to them the sole responsibility of ensuring them a profit, not a loss. They also said, every single foot in our films is our own responsibility and nobody else's. We refuse to be guided or coerced by any influence but our own judgment. And then finally, perhaps, no artist believes in escapism, and we secretly believe that no audience does. We have proved, at any rate, that they will pay to see the truth for other reasons than her nakedness. I think, again, this would speak against the usual idea of propaganda, but I think you can see these ideas, especially also in the propagandistic elements of this. They ask something else of themselves and their work than your usual propagandist does.
And I think in terms of it being just part of their filmmaking, that they felt, we are making films, when we make a film, we want it to mean something. We want it to have a point that we've chosen to put in it. That's a sort of filmmaking philosophy that if the government comes along and says, we want you to make these films for propagandist purposes, and if you also buy in the same goal that the government has, then you are a very neat fit to make propaganda. So I think the two coming together actually worked really well. They had a good philosophy to embrace propaganda and make it really interesting.
So shall we basically go into the three films that we're talking about and perhaps do them chronologically?
Yeah, I think if we go to the first one then, which would be, I think I would say my favourite of the three. And I think the one I find possibly the most thrilling for its propagandist element is The 49th Parallel from 1941. And at heart, it is the fact that this is a propaganda film where the protagonists are Nazis. We are following Nazis on their adventure. I won't say we're rooting for them, but we become involved in their struggle and all the individual characters, their struggle. And the story sort of puts you in that world. And that, I think, is why I just find it such fun to watch as propaganda.
Absolutely. I mean, as you said, they're Nazis. It's the crew of a Nazi submarine that is basically destroyed in Canada. So the surviving crew members try to make it across Canada to, I think, America, you know, any kind of port where they can get out of America and to save ground. Now, even though the protagonists are Nazis, but they're obviously not heroes, they are at the same time the villains of the piece. And that is something very rare, especially, I think, in cinema of this era.
And I think that's such a unique element of it, that you're introduced to this group who have a mission. And the conventional way of a film is these are your heroes. They're stuck behind enemy lines and they've got to get their goal is to ultimately triumph by reaching America and for them at the time, safety. So you've got this format that is so recognizable. But then when you actually look at the people who are, you know, the fellowship that are going on this quest, they're Nazis. They are, you know, all presented as part of this squadron that was basically killing, bombing people, bombing ships off Canada. And then suddenly their submarine gets destroyed and they're stuck. And then it basically is, these are the characters, this is what they want to do, and this film will now follow them. And that sort of just that sort of, it's the same but different. It's a weird mirror reflection of what you'd sort of normally expect from an action, adventure, wartime propaganda film.
And I think even though they're Nazis, they are not panto villains. They're perhaps not presented with extreme depth. That's just not the kind of film it is. But they are presented with a certain nuance. And what is also interesting, especially for a wartime film, their villainy doesn't lie in their nationality, but it lies in their ideology. And I think the film is interested in depicting exactly this ideology and the clash of ideologies. Because, I mean, the film is kind of very episodic. It's almost, it becomes a kind of road movie, you know. They basically get from one episode to another episode. They encounter these kind of French-Canadian trappers, one of them played by Laurence Olivier, which is a wonderfully ludicrous but kind of very, very enjoyable performance. Later on, they meet this group of Hutterites, who, interestingly, they're mostly from Germany. But they depict this ideal of a multicultural Canada. Basically, it's these episodes. Later on, I think they meet this British tourist in Canada. And each of these episodes, it's very enjoyable to watch. It's kind of exciting. But each of them also kind of depicts a certain element of the culture that these Nazis are against. And I think that's done in a very fascinating way.
And I think it's really good the way they do present that. But also there's enough nuance between the Nazis themselves that their reaction to all these encounters is different. That you sort of see that it sort of presents the sort of broad church of Nazism, that you have people who were sort of like, oh, they joined the party because they were young and it was the only, they kind of had to do it. Where you have the idealists, you have people who would possibly just have done it because it was good for them to do at the time. And so you have all these people who are under the umbrella of Nazism. What happens when they encounter something, when they encounter these different aspects of Canada, that it provokes combat within the group? That then is part of the dynamic of the storytelling. That these I keep wanting to say heroes, which is obviously the wrong word, but this group that are adventuring in this film, you know, their disagreements is part of the drama. And that's really interesting how they sort of engage with that and where that leads to and how that makes you engage with them as characters in a way that you wouldn't expect to do with Nazis.
Absolutely. And it would have been so easy to make them panto villains. I mean, they are Nazis, so it doesn't take much work, but they are humanized without kind of making them, you know, without softening them. It still is very clear about what is evil about this ideology. And it is very fascinating how it does that, especially in these encounters with Canadians who embody not Canada as a fact, but Canada as also an ideal. And as you said, it's multiculturalism that I think is at the center of this ideal.
I mean, it would have been all too easy to make the Nazis like a faceless block, that they were all the same. You shoot them in a certain light that makes them look evil. They all do evil cackling. They're all the same. That would have been a very easy way of doing propaganda. And I think the step back to basically say, no, are we going to present a disparate group of humans that you will enjoy watching them disagree, watching them have arguments as humans would, that is then going to get you into the idea that this is actually what the Nazis are. And they're not a sort of faceless mass of evil. They are evil, but there is nuance to it. And I think it does that so well throughout the film.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the one film that Powell and Pressburger were approached by the British Ministry of Information to make. And it was all about basically swaying opinion, especially in the United States, who hadn't yet entered the war. Though ironically, by the time the film came out, Pearl Harbor had happened and the United States were a party to the war. What is your view of, you know, on the Canadian encounters that our group of Nazi protagonists has?
I mean, it is the heart of the propaganda here, I think, is please, America, help us. There's a war on. I think that is the reason why this film exists. And I think it's sort of shot through that sort of the encounters with a lot of the people in Canada are, I think, sort of deliberately chosen to sort of say, well, you know, you will understand this better as America. We're not rooting for an old European country on the other side of the pond that you think are sort of ingrained in all the old grand European empires and all the stuff that, say, led to the First World War, all the stuff that is sort of like you'd gone to North America to escape. This is Canada. This is people who also have come to North America to escape. You've got a very different way of living in this place that I think Americans would have sort of recognized that this is, you know, this is their neighbor. So I think a lot of that is to some extent to show Nazism put against a recognizable North American environment. I think that's often at the heart of the film. I think a lot of the color is specifically Canadian, but I think that's what Powell and Pressburger liked doing. I think all the stuff that happens, they would have been interested in. I think the world of the French Canadians, I think that would have fascinated them anyway. And then they get someone in to play it with an astonishing accent. It's an amazing piece of work. I mean, part of me, when I watch it, I'm sort of like, well, this seems like a comedy French accent, but then I don't entirely know how French Canadian trappers who've been on their own for 12 months speak. So maybe this has been a really well researched, and it is exactly how they speak, and it's the rest of France that's got it wrong, or the rest of Quebec that's got it wrong. So maybe there's that, but all these different encounters, although they're within Canada, they're still, I think there's a frame to them to sort of say to America, look, this is what can happen. This is what is being fought for. These are the people that the Nazis are against, that they're a danger to. Don't you want to do something about that?
I think what is interesting, though, is that at least with some of the encounters that the protagonists have, there's a comedic, there's a funny, goofy element to the people that they encounter. I mean, yes, there's basically Laurence Olivier with his glorious accent. And I think the way he's portrayed, there is definitely an element there where you can laugh at the character. There's the same element of goofiness, I think, later on with the English tourist who's basically camping out in the forests of Canada. He is someone that you can laugh at to some extent. And I think that is also part of the whole thing, that the Nazis, you can't laugh at them. They are so serious and so kind of steely and so humorless in their ideology. And I think that is part of what we're also supposed to see. You know, these people that are more comedic, they are also, there's a warmth there. There's a humanity there that I think is quite key.
And I think it's a really heart of a basic message that you go, look at this fun person. Isn't he fun? Oh God, the Nazis have killed him. That, you know, this is what Nazis do. Like, you sort of create likable scenarios in the film. The Nazis are a threat to them. The Nazis may kill them. And I think, you know, some of them die, some of them don't. But once it's established that they will kill them, every time they turn up somewhere and you meet a new likable, like I said, slightly goofy figure, you're worried that the Nazis are going to kill them. And then that becomes part of the drama. But I think also part of the message that, you know, Nazis have no time for whimsy and goofiness. That's why they're bad.
I think the one episode that probably drops this humor the most is the one with the Hutterites, where you've got Anton Walbrook as the leader of the Hutterites. And I think that's also where the film perhaps turns to speechifying a bit, but there's at the same time an earnestness to it that makes it still work a lot for me. And I think it's also just, you know, you've got the more thrilling sequence, then you've got the more earnest sequence, and then you've got the more humorous sequence to some extent. And I think that's all part of the modulations this film goes through in its story.
I mean, the speechifying is definitely true, but I think you've got to a point where these are an earnest people. So this is the point to then have like an earnest moment. And this is, I think, again, this is possibly my favorite part of the film, I think, just because it is so unexpected for a propaganda film to then have a situation where the Nazis meet basically Germans in Canada. And then the discussion is, well, you should be with us. And so you're almost having this discussion between Germans in Canada and Germans under the Nazi regime about what they should do and where they should stand. and it's in a British propaganda film, that that is a decision that you would not come across often. And the reason given by the Hutterite leader to basically say, no, I reject you, is not because I love the Queen and Britain is best and yay, I hope they win the war. The reasons they're giving are ideologically tied to who they are as Germans who fled Europe to build a new life in North America. So again, I think you've got this idea that it's speaking to an American audience where that idea will chime really strongly, that the threat from Nazis isn't against Britain and its imperialist interests, which I think was the heart of a lot of Nazi propaganda. Like, well, why do you want to get involved in this, America? It is just two empires fighting. It's none of your business. So it sort of is addressing that by saying, no, no, this is what is going on here. There is an ideology that is so opposed to everything you stand for. If it is not stopped, it is going to destroy it. And I think this sequence, the very speech at the heart, the two sort of speeches, the Nazi gives a speech and then the leader of the Hutterites, is that philosophy intact. But even around that, I think the Hutterites, they still have their own element of whimsy. So you have that side of, you know, that they are quite fun people in a weird way. Their earnestness is quite amusing. And then at the same time, you have within the group dynamic, you have a bit of a tragedy. You get this idea that one of the Nazis wants to stay and, spoilers, doesn't end well for him. That this is part of just writing good drama and all the pieces are fitting together to move the story along, that then it covers the ideology, it covers the persuasive bit that it wants to say, and then it also is just fun to watch.
Now, since we're at Anton Walbrook, shall we move on to the second film?
Mm-hmm, yep.
The second film is The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which was released in 1943. This is also, I think, probably the first Powell and Pressburger film that I ever saw, at least the first one that I saw consciously knowing that it was a Powell and Pressburger film. And I think it is the film of these three that is probably most about an idea of Britishness in the face of World War II. But again, it's interesting that we've got Anton Walbrook as Theo Kretschmar-Schuldorf. So a German soldier in World War I, later an immigrant into the UK. And I would say it's the German character in a propaganda film during World War II who's the most mature, perhaps, who's the most nuanced, who's also the most conflicted, which I think is absolutely stunning if you consider this a film, you know, to be made in 43 in order to kind of persuade the audience to do something, to be something, to have a certain kind of point of view.
Yes, and I think I'm just trying to remember the title of the Billy Wilder film that's set in North Africa, or the Five Graves to Cairo. And I was really struck, I watched that not that long ago, and it really gives the sort of lead German, I mean, he's still a villain, but he has a personality to him. The film gives him very likable elements. And I find this quite astonishing because Billy Wilder was making this film after he'd learned that his family had been wiped out by Nazis. And then he is going to a Nazi character and he is making them seem human. And there is a quality, I think, in the best propaganda to do this. And I think it is different in Blimp in the sense that the German is not a Nazi that's being humanized. He is a German who is not a Nazi, and he is probably the most human character in there. But just that mental leap to say, we are making a propaganda film, and as part of that process, we will humanize who we should be targeting propaganda against, is what makes them very sort of atypical in terms of what propaganda is. And I adore this film. This is absolutely a wonderful film. It's a film, probably one of the films I've watched more than any other. And again, I think going back to being the child of immigrants, I think this is their most clear-cut, I suppose you'd almost say Pressburgian idea, that Englishness is something that is almost chosen. That for the German at the end, oh, he's not giving up being German, but there is something here that he loves, and that is what Britain should celebrate about itself, that there is a quality here that, like, that is what is a real strength of the country. And that, I think, is such an interesting idea. It's an idea that I think it resonated with me when I first saw this film. And I think to build a film around this idea is really interesting anyway. To do it when a war is on is just incredible.
And it's also, if you look at the main English or British character in this, I mean, the film is called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, and there is no character in it called Colonel Blimp. But you've got Roger Livesey, who plays Clive Wincandy, who's loosely based on the cartoon character of Colonel Blimp. And when you see him first, he is a cartoon character. He seems a joke. He's this old, pompous, reactionary idea of Britishness. And that's how we get to know him. And then basically what the film does, it goes from him when he's already old, when he's basically a part of the Home Guard and no longer an active soldier. It goes back to his youth, or basically his days as a soldier of the Boer War, later then the First World War. And in some ways, he is a cartoon. He is a joke, but he is not only a joke. There is an honor to him, especially to begin with. And at the same time, there is an obliviousness. He represents a certain idea of Britain that probably never existed, that definitely never existed. And perhaps that's something we'll have to talk about later. But it's very much these two characters. So you've got the archetypical Brit and you've got the German. And it's the German who's the more grown up of the two. He's also the one who's more willing to look in the face of reality and take certain conclusions from that. Whereas Clive lives in a fantasy world to some extent, which is very appealing, especially once you get to know him as a young man. But it is a fantasy world. I think that's, you can totally see why Churchill wasn't a fan.
But I think it's also, I think part of it, or my reading part of it, is that one of the elements of the difference is just the life they had to lead. The challenges that the German faces has meant he had to mature in a way that Blimp, you know, the Candy, just didn't have to, that he has lived in a idealized fantasy because he hasn't met with the same troubles and hasn't met with the same defeats. And so I do wonder whether part of it is a bit of a story that's sort of like, that's the reason he is why he is. It's not something ingrained in being English. It is because the first half of the late 19th, beginning of the 20th century has kind of created these two different national stories, one of which creates a German who is far more thoughtful because he's had to deal with so much more than the guy who is effectively on the winning side and to some extent has then been indulged in his fantasy. And I really like Candy in this because, like, the sort of Colonel Blimp in the sort of original cartoon execution is just meant to be an attack on the character. Like, Colonel Blimp is meant to be basically, this is what is wrong in Britain. He's an isolationist, doesn't like the common people, he doesn't get a lot of the modern world. And I think that was the original cartoons are someone, Blimp is how I'm going to attack those attitudes. And there is something really interesting in the way that they don't just repeat that. That they, oh, okay, this is definitely part of Britishness. This is something that is all around us. They could probably see it. But then they still take a step to humanize it. And it is still part of the story of this is, it is not something that can just be damned outright. There is a person here. It is interesting. There are reasons why they are that person. And they are sort of, it's a story that's worth watching. So again, it's almost propaganda. It's almost taking a character that was used to very much attack, I think, a sort of British, conservative, imperialist attitude and kind of create a British, conservative, imperial character that you end up liking by the end of the film.
You like him, but you don't have to agree with him to like him. I think, again, that is something that they do that's very interesting, which will also, I think, come back with a Canterbury Tale, where you could say that the villain of the piece is also sympathetic, but that doesn't mean that he's not wrong. So I think you have that same element here with Clive Wincandy. With Anton Walbrook's Theo Kretschmar Schuldorf, what I find fascinating is there's one moment in the film after World War One where he's a POW in England. He's invited to a dinner at Clive's place where there's all these well-meaning Brits kind of lecturing him, Britsplaining to him. And when he then basically has to return to Germany, he's, I think, in a train or something together with other German ex-POWs. And he has a speech that could almost be the origin story of a villain, you know, where basically he expresses his bitterness, his disappointment, but also his, how should I say this? He looks down on these parochial Brits in their fantasy land, in their fantasy version of Britain. And this is totally where you could see the character also going in two different directions. He could become a Nazi, and yet he doesn't. You know, we don't have the moment when he chooses the other path. We have the moment afterwards when he tells us about what happened to him over the last 10, 20 years. And that's fascinating. It's also, I think, Walbrook is a fantastic actor to depict this ambivalence. He can be very dark. He can be extremely personable. And I think he does both of these things in bringing an extremely complex, fascinating character to life.
It is that sort of idea of, like, what do you learn from defeat? And like you said, I think in the end, he is learning the right message. I think you find that out over the course of the film, but you could easily see it as the defeat. You know, the bitterness that it creates is what is leading to the Nazis that, again, they're an existential threat when this film is made. Like, this isn't sort of like a nice historical period drama. That you could see this film being made in the 50s or 60s as a curio. This is being made when war is happening. This is a film being made with wartime resources. And it kind of has a bit of mockery about the British Army, which I think is the heart that, like, Churchill found unforgivable. That it sort of says, you know, the sort of British Army by the end of the, you know, by the First World War, it's been led by these sort of pompous generals, this sort of aristocracy. It has these problems. And I think the notion that it might have this sort of element of buffoonery in it was seen as a sort of unforgivable, making a film when that same army is fighting. I think the counter to that is, I think a lot of the audience would have seen it and they would have recognized that. And they would have said, well, this is something we do have as a problem. This is something that is part of our army. But again, I think part of the genius of the film is that, having highlighted this problem, it kind of isn't condemning it outright. It isn't saying, and therefore we're in the wrong, or therefore, you know, this is why we'll lose. It is just basically saying, this is part of it and we can deal with it, and we're just aware that it's there, so that we're not lying to you that everything is perfect in the British Army. But you know what? On balance, yeah, we're still better than the Nazis. And then, you know, that is sort of like it's an interesting gamble to take compared to the more obvious propaganda, which would have been just, our army's brilliant and their army's evil. Let's go and be brilliant and defeat them. And, you know, to some extent, you know, Candy, you know, his view that they won the World War because, you know, right as might, we had the power to do it, and that is vindicated by our success. That's wrong. And a propaganda film that tried to say, yeah, we will win because might is right and we have the power, it's kind of like, well, that's not necessarily true. To win, it will require other qualities than just this sort of simplistic belief. And I think that's in this film as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely this idea of, you know, in order to beat the Nazis, you have to play dirty. You have to take on some of their methods. And I think that's a very interesting one. I think it's one point where I find myself not knowing quite how I feel about the film. Also because, in, you know, this whole right is might thing that Clive has, I'm not sure whether it's the character who's naive about the actual crimes of British imperialism, or whether the film itself also idealizes Britain a lot here. I think it's probably the latter with a touch of the former, because, for instance, it starts off with the whole, you know, what did the Brits do during the Boer War, and were they just the good guys and the other side was the bad guys? And I mean, the Boer War is the war where the term concentration camps was coined, and it was something that the Brits came up with, obviously not to the exact same effect as the Nazis did later on, but British imperialism has so many dark sides that we could fill a whole year of podcasts with. So again, having this British, ultra-British character defend this idealized idea of the empire, but he is also a buffoon, and he's someone who is likable, but not necessarily right. How do you deal with that side of the film, the idealization of a certain idea of Britain?
I think it feels of its time. So again, you're watching other films of the period, and this is the norm. It is interesting that it is the Boers that is the war, and that is kind of, to some extent, the heart of his sort of imperial ambition. Because I think on the list of stuff that you'd present in a jovial way about what he's been up to in the empire, that's a lot less problematic than what they could have put on screen. There's parts of the world that if he'd gone to and he'd had a great military record, you would watch that part of the film and it was just almost like, this film is now irredeemable now that you've reminded me of these atrocities. I think there's something, maybe it was deliberate to, like, you know what, the Boers were also white. This is slightly different war than you'd sort of, you know, when we just went and massacred people elsewhere in the world that weren't white. I wonder whether that's sort of a deliberate thing to just make the film look a little bit less loaded. But I think that there is a flag waving element to it. And I think I saw you sort of get that in the sense that both that was the norm for the time, but also, you know, they are making a propaganda film. And, you know, you have to have that element, I think, within the film, or I think they would actually have been stopped. Although I think there's nothing I've seen from both of them that made me think they probably didn't believe it as well, that they would have been quiet. They would have very much, I think, been on the view that ultimately, yeah, it did a few bad things, but ultimately the British Empire probably on balance was one of the better ones. So this sort of weird low-key British patriotism that exists, I think they both would have very much bought into that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I also find it interesting, you know, there's these two sequences where something happens in Clive's life that does basically, it doesn't go how he wants it to go. And then he compensates for that by going off to these faraway places and killing all these animals. You basically have these shots of the wall in his study where the heads of, you know, elephants and rhinos and lions appear, which is very much played for laughs. But I also have to say there is a kind of, there's an underlying element here of, you know, a Britishman will go and kill beautiful animals instead of going to therapy, so to speak.
And it also hints at the fact that, you know, he is in a position where he can go to all these exotic locations because basically at the time they're controlled by Britain. And you could have a very similar sequence in a propaganda film that was really designed to tear apart Britain. You would have the same sequence and it would be like, look at this horrible man, what he's doing. And he goes around the world because Britain rules the world and this is what he does. Isn't he awful? But I think it is just done for fun. So I think either they sort of knew they could get away with it or they didn't even see that angle. But it is interesting that you could almost recontextualize that concept and make it part of a film that was very much anti the British Empire.
I think with both of the films that we've talked about now, they both do things very differently from what we expect. You've got one film where you've got, you know, the Nazis being protagonists in an adventure. You've got another film where the archetypical Brit is a bit of a cartoon, a bit of a joke. You like him, but you also see that he is wrong. I think with all three films, I've kept asking myself, which of these three films is the most unexpected and is the strangest? And I have to say, I keep coming back to Canterbury Tale, which is also the last film of these that I've seen, that I think is so strange in certain respects. When did you first see A Canterbury Tale? Was that an early one you saw or a later one?
I think it's relatively early. I think quite early on, I got a box set. It was very early days of DVDs that had a run of their films on it. And I sort of worked my way through it. And this one was an oddity. This one did not. And I think even then I sort of watched it not quite spotting that it was made during the war as wartime propaganda. I mean, it is something that if you watch World War II period stuff today, so much World War period stuff has been made after the war that you almost assume that's where it comes from. That it is such a source of narratives in British entertainment that we go back to the war, the Second World War, and, you know, explore and celebrate aspects of it. I think all the costumes required for evacuee kids and land girls and everything, they must just be used all the time. There must be a warehouse that has never had to shut down completely because it is such a part of dramatic culture. So I think I watched it thinking, oh, this is a period drama set in World War II. Without realizing this was made during World War II. And that just makes it even odder. It feels like an oddity as a period drama. And then to think they were making this, the war is still on. It is such an odd film.
It's the one film also where I think for the longest time, the war almost seems to be absent because literally it is happening elsewhere. In the first film, you've got battle scenes in 49th parallel. You've got the submarine being basically blown up. You've got fighting scenes with the Nazi soldiers. In Colonel Blimp, while you don't see World War II, you have World War I scenes. And I think they are definitely also read as in, this is war, you know, trench warfare, people dying. It doesn't hide any of that. And then you get to A Canterbury Tale, which is all set in this bucolic rural England in Kent, where you've got three characters, a US soldier, John Sweet plays him. He's always kind of credited as Sergeant John Sweet, US Army, as if that's his name, who plays Bob Johnson from Oregon. And you've got Dennis Price, who I only found out today that he's also the lead in Kind Hearts and Coronets, who plays a UK soldier. And you've got Sheila Sim as Alison Smith, a land girl. So a woman from London who basically during the war goes and works in the rural countryside on the farms and everything, because that's where you needed a workforce, because all the men were basically off fighting the war. And it is definitely, I think, the most obviously whimsical of these films. But even though the war seems to be strangely absent, it comes back every now and then. Every now and then you're reminded, no, there's a war going on. There's people dying. The way it does that is very strange, because it is, in different hands, this film could be twee. And I think it perhaps skirts this once or twice, but it manages not to fall into that trap, I think. What do you think?
I still feel sort of puzzled by this film. I do think it feels twee. I don't know whether it quite escapes that tag. I can read convincing reasons why it doesn't. It is sort of this strange setup that the strongest influence of the war on this is basically it's the reason why the three lead characters are where they are at the start, that then leads them to have, you know, a walk in the countryside and solve a crime. I mean, this is what we'll say. So that's the only reason the three of them ever, you know, it is a war that causes that. And yeah, you have this sort of background detail that constantly reminds you that there is a war on, but it's not the story. And I still feel nonplussed by this film sometimes. I watch it and I don't quite know what to make of it. It's such a peculiar film that you can reach the end of it and have a real sort of like, huh, moment. Whereas rather than I think the other two are sort of, they're enjoyable, but you can have a moment at the end that you've enjoyed it as propaganda. I reach the end of this and it's propaganda. It's really tricky to gauge.
I mean, it's also, I think it's the film where Paul and Pressburger became most playful to some extent. I mean, there's playful elements in all of them, definitely also in Colonel Blimp, where you've got this wonderful cut without a cut, you know, from basically the 1940s to the 1910s, where you don't basically edit, but basically the camera just pans away from the old character and pans back to the young character. Here you've got, I think, something that prefigures the iconic time jump in 2001, where you've got a medieval falcon in the air cutting straight to a Spitfire plane, which is wonderful. And I think it's this playfulness. I think it's perhaps this is the film where I found myself loving it for the elements, but perhaps less so for the whole that it then becomes, because I'm not sure it becomes a unifying whole. So you've got these three characters, as you said, in Kent. The two soldiers, so the American and the Brit, they're basically waiting to be deployed to mainland Europe. You've got the female lead who's a land girl who's there. And you've got this mystery of the glue man. So basically women in this small town have glue put on their heads by the glue man. And they're trying to figure out who is the glue man, why is he doing it, and how to stop him. So there is this weird whodunit element to it, which is completely, well, out of place. It's the glue that holds this story together, so to speak. But it is very strange, especially because the culprit is both completely misguided, but also likable. And I think the film and Paul and Pressburger have a lot of sympathy for his point of view.
I think that's the thing that jars most with me, in the sense, and this is really quite surprising, because I've, you know, we've watched two films where it's Germans and it's the first one that's Nazis, and I can get my brain quite easily round the idea of following and being engaged with, you know, some of the Nazis in the first film. I find the sympathy for the man who throws glue in women's hair really bizarre. It's, and I try to engage with it, but then I think I sort of slightly bounce off it a little bit. He sort of gives his justification and all the other characters go, oh yeah, hmm. And I'm sitting there going like, no, this is a freakish, weird thing to do. I mean, his justification is that, like, you know, if women are too scared to go out at night, they will stay faithful to their men that are off away fighting, and it will sort of keep society in a better position. That seems to be the reason why he's doing it. Oh, and also it encourages people to come to his lecture.
I mean, that is very relatable, isn't it? You know, someone who wants an audience. He should have a podcast, don't you think?
I think he would have a podcast, but I can't escape the idea that it would be a really dodgy podcast. And so it sort of reframes, I think, a little bit the whimsy that maybe hasn't aged that well. You know, you have these sequences set at the time of Chaucer, and there's a tweeness into that. And then his sort of I think he wants to defend this. I think feels very close to sort of poisonous politics we have in the UK at the moment. So there's aspects of this that I maybe can see where they're coming from, but I don't know whether it's aged that well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think another factor, which I think sort of this film lives in the shadow of the later film, A Matter of Life and Death, which is made sort of after the war, so probably doesn't fall within the remit of wartime propaganda, but I think was made with the view of, you know, we want to get along with Americans. Now that the world is rebuilt, please make a film about how we can get on with Americans. And actually, I think there is part of that in this film. So I think this film is kind of being made for an American audience to basically say, isn't Britain lovely? And aren't we brothers? Let's get on in the post-war world. This is also the first film, A Canterbury Tale, that it's made during the time of war, but the end was in sight. So I think some of the thinking is sort of like, okay, we're going to make films to deal with the world after the war. And so this is sort of stepped up to be a film celebrating how great Britain is. So I don't know, maybe Americans might want to come here and have a holiday. And it's got a sort of charismatic American soldier who I do find great as the film goes on. He has one mode of acting, but you know, he's likable. He meets these likable British people and they have a bit of an adventure together. That feels like, let's do this in the future, Britain and America. And so it has all these elements that I think are there deliberately, but then they sort of revisit in A Matter of Life and Death and make a much better film. And, you know, you've got the opening, which is the pilgrims traveling to Canterbury, which is incredibly twee. And you compare that to sort of David Niven's monologue when he's dying at the opening of A Matter of Life and Death, which I think frames a sort of what they're going for in isn't culture lovely kind of way. I think that does this so much better in terms of engaging you with ideas that on paper could be twee, but they do actually mean something. They are important. Whereas I think with this film, they just seem twee. They just seem silly. And I kind of feel I'm having to do the work to go, okay, no, it is important that we have this past and there's Canterbury Cathedral and this pilgrimage. And that is the thing worth fighting for. I kind of feel I have to bring that to this film. This film doesn't persuade me of it.
I know what you mean. I think I like the film probably better than you do. Again, more for its bits than for the whole thing. But I think it is a film that, in order to really like it, you have to kind of bend and twist it into certain shapes that the film allows for, but doesn't do itself. I think, for instance, with the glue man, it totally has sympathy for him, but I think it also says that he is finally wrong. And we do see kind of the alternative to his world to some extent in the end, where, you know, you have the women and the soldiers going to the lectures together. So, you know, he doesn't need to resort to glue. He just has to invite the women as well. And then everything is fine. There's also the element that the glue man, there is a weirdly almost angelic element to him in how he's presented. At one point, he just vanishes after, you know, his work is done here. But at the same time, he is played by the same guy who played the leader of the Nazi crew in Fortnite's Parallel. And I think there is, he is not someone who's immediately likable. There's a sternness to him. There's also a coldness to him that I think the film uses to maintain an ambivalence that still doesn't quite work out. But the other thing is also in terms of the tweeness, I agree with you about the Canterbury beginning, you know, set in the past. If it didn't have that 2001 time jump, which I think...
No, that is brilliant.
And it's that kind of inventiveness that I really appreciate about the film. There's also, for instance, there's this one sequence where the boys of the village, they play at war. And strangely enough, I think, especially when I first saw it, I was taken by how intense that is. Because I think this is where we've had bucolic Kentish, you know, countryside. And suddenly we've got kids playing at war, but it's not that far in terms of how it's presented, in terms of how it's filmed from actual war films. So suddenly it's like, oh yeah, there's an actual war happening elsewhere. And you've got this also, you've got this sequence later on when they actually end up in Canterbury at the end of their pilgrimage, so to speak. And the female lead, she's looking for a garage and she basically finds all these gaps in the streets where the buildings have been bombed in this case, probably. So the war has left gaps. And again, it's this moment of, okay, we've had borderline twee or outright twee countryside adventures that could almost be out of Enid Blyton. And suddenly you're reminded, no, the war is still going on. And I think it's these contrasts, which I don't think the contrasts quite work out, but I find them quite striking and quite effective. But as you said, we have to do a lot of the work as an audience to bend it into something that works for us.
And I do like it as a film. And I've always sort of said, I have such a premium watching films if I can't predict what's going to happen. And this is very much a film that falls into that. And it has elements that you kind of think, oh, I know where this is going, and you don't. And I'm very much along for the journey, the way it tells its story, the sort of different elements. Like you said, the sort of kids that are playing at war. There's a sort of a moment in a church where someone gets to play the organ. And these things you don't see coming, that there's not an element of conventionality to them. And I enjoy the film for that. I think when I first saw it, that was how I was enjoying it. I was along for a ride, because the thing that strikes me in every subsequent rewatch is I did not realize who the glue man was until he confesses. And the moment you rewatch the film, it is obviously that person. It could not be anyone else. It is absolutely, from the moment he's introduced, the film makes no secret. He could just have a big sign on his head just going, I did it. But I think I was so just following the story as it winds around, and then the characters start thinking it might be him, and I was thinking, well, it might be him, but it might not be. And so you get to that, until he confesses, I was like, maybe it isn't him. And you watch it again, and it clearly is him, and it kind of shows you that at the really early on in the film, that it must be this person. And again, I think I like films that can hide stuff in plain sight from you, but also I think that probably is how I sort of engage with this film, that I'm not so involved. It is a bit more leisurely, that you can follow it and wind down the way to Canterbury with the characters, which again is great. Really weird for a propaganda film made when there's a war on.
I mean, it's also, I think, of these three films, if I had to recommend just one, I think for me it would clearly be Colonel Blimp, but there might even be an argument for 49th Parallel. A Canterbury Tale, I think, is one that I would only recommend once someone has already become slightly hooked, yes, on Powell and Pressburger.
I think if someone asked to watch a Powell and Pressburger film, you would not want to start with Canterbury Tale. Either of the other two films here, I think, are better films, but I think they'd also give you a good idea of why they were, in their own way, sort of very critically successful. I think Canterbury Tale is the one you watch sixth or seventh once you've got into it, and you can enjoy it in that context. Yeah, definitely.
So how do these films hold up? I think we've already addressed that to some extent. How do they hold up 60 years later, 70 years later? I should have done my maths before this. Obviously, the wartime context is no longer there. We don't have to be convinced of, you know, the need to fight the Nazis. So do you think they hold up well, and do they hold up well in spite of their propagandistic elements, or to some extent also because of them?
It is because of them. I don't think you can look at these films without engaging with the propaganda element of them. I think they exist to be propaganda. And I think that the extent to which they are propaganda makes it very hard to watch them without that aspect to it. I think the first one is the most still successful on that score. I think it is an engaging action film. I think you can't come away with it without a clear idea that Nazis aren't great and we should probably fight them, which ultimately is what you want from your propaganda. I think the other films are far more sort of interesting, and the message is less clear. And I think you do need to go some distance to work out what they were trying to do propaganda-wise, but it still is sort of the heart of the film. So I don't know whether they work. I always think it's interesting. The 49th Parallel was a huge hit in America. And like you said, it sort of coincided with Pearl Harbor, which made the whole point of the film moot. But I do wonder whether it would have been the sort of film that, had Pearl Harbor not happened, would have been successful at changing minds. I have a feeling it could have been. It's good enough that it could potentially have done that. Whereas I think the other films are ones you can enjoy, I'm not sure they're changing many people's minds.
But I do think all three films, they do, as we've said, very interesting things, surprising things, strange and weird things. As I said, I do think that Powell and Pressburger, there was something very traditional to their filmmaking, but there was also something extremely experimental to their filmmaking. As I said, the 2001 shot, you know, decades before 2001 came around, there is a strangeness and an unusual perspective, which also, as we've talked about, I think Pressburger probably also contributed a lot of that, that it's an idealization of an idea of Britain that doesn't come from someone who was born into Britishness, but who came to choose it. I totally agree with you on that one. And I do think all three films for that, sometimes for the whole of it, sometimes for certain elements, are totally worth watching, as I would say are most of Paul and Pressburger's films. I'm glad that we finally got around to talking to about the two of them, because we've been talking about this for a long time, and I think this angle was a very interesting one to do it from.
I mean, it's such an interesting collection of films that they made that, you know, we could pick three others, come up with some sort of linking context, and then we could do a similar interesting podcast. Their films are worth watching, and it's a really good filmography to explore. And these three are great. And like I said, I mentioned A Matter of Life and Death. We've touched upon it. It's kind of excluded from this because it's sort of post-war. But again, there's so much you could say about that. You could then start linking it to maybe some of the other films. They made a propaganda film after the 49th parallel, which is again fighter pilots trying to get out. One of our aircraft is missing, where the pilots are British. And it's kind of like, it's not as good. They've used the same techniques, and it's a gripping story, but weirdly, it works better as propaganda if they're Nazis. But I think there's, you know, you will find, you could collect any three of their films, and I think we could make a podcast from it, because there's so much to say about all of them.
Absolutely, and I think I would definitely be up for that podcast. So shall we put that on the list of ideas, of which we have way too many?
Add another one, but yeah, no, let's start working, narrowing down which three come next.
Perhaps we'll just have to do a summer series at some point, the summer of Paul and Pressburg. I mean, they're alliterative. That's already half the work done.
I'm trying to think. I mean, summer begins with S, but I can't think. Is there a language where we can find a time period beginning with P? We'll have to do some research on that. But I think if we're running with alliteration, the whole season needs to be alliterative. The period of Paul and Pressburger, I think we need to go all in on the P's.
Or we just switch to French, and then it's Le Printemps de Paul et Pressburger.
That works for me.
We'll have to get someone who can do a really good French-Canadian kind of Laurence Olivier impersonation.
It would have to be Laurence Olivier. It can't be proper French-Canadian. I think we'd have to do it in that style. That would be the way to do it.
Absolutely. So thanks a lot, Alan. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too. And always up for talking about Paul and Pressburger.
And as always, thank you very much to our audience. And we will be back very soon with our summer series for 2026. And in the meantime, there will be blog posts, there will be espressos, there will be plenty damn fine cups of culture. Goodbye.
Bye.